This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
I'm a god and you're a god. And I'm a god and I'm going to stay a god until you recognize that you're god. And when you recognize you're god, I shall go back into principle and will not appear as a personality.
You are god.
But until I see all of you knowing who you are, I'm going to be very much what I am. God Almighty God.
That's the voice of Jim Jones, one of the most notorious cult leaders of the 20th century, who led over 900 of his followers to commit mass suicide in 1978. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and you're with The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. Today, my guest is one of the world's leading experts on mind control, as practiced by religious and other groups to control the behavior of their followers. And he should know. Steve Hassan was one of the early recruits of another group, whose mass actions, thankfully, are usually confined to mass weddings.
In today's moral climate, Reverend and Mrs. Moon are showing a way to restore and strengthen the true standards of love within marriage and family.
The Unification Church, known popularly as the Moonies, was founded in the late 50s by Sun Myung Moon, a Korean businessman who set himself up in America as the Messiah. The Moonies' early recruitment drives became synonymous with indoctrination methods that were used during the Korean War. A host of academic studies and films documented the psychological process that changed young people with no religious zeal into organized foot soldiers who worked round the clock for their newfound leaders. The radical behavior change prompted family and friends to take action, and deprogramming sessions of followers were given legal support during the 1970s and 80s. 20 years later, all that's changed, and Steve Hassan, who started as a naive recruit of the Moonies, has turned his attention to counseling people who've been in all kinds of situations that exert extreme control over a person, depriving them of their mental and physical freedom. He's written Combating Cult Mind Control and Releasing the Bonds. Steve Hassan, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
My pleasure.
Steve, this is an anniversary year for you. 30 years ago, you left the Moonies, a religious group founded by a Korean self-proclaimed messiah, Sun Myung Moon. Why was leaving the Moonies momentous for you?
Oh, I almost died when I fell asleep at the wheel of a fundraising van. I had been up for 2 days without sleep and was pried out of the wreckage by emergency technicians and had a broken leg and spent 2 weeks in the hospital. And it opened the door for me to contact my sister, who I missed very much, and an intervention that led to me waking up and realizing that I had been a victim of deception and mind control.
Before we get to the issue of mind control and how you got out, what actually drew you into a group that exercised such control over you?
Essentially, I had broken up with a girlfriend and was very depressed about it. But I should say that I was an English major. I wrote poetry and short stories and grew up in a conservative Jewish family and had no interest in changing religions or joining any other religion. It really was a situation of me thinking that the women that were approaching me were interested in me. In fact, they were recruiters, and they lied many times in their approach to me. And it was a step-by-step seduction.
They actually whisked you away to a Moonie compound, as it was called in those days?
Yeah, it started with an invitation to a free dinner to meet their friends, and then, oh, we're going away this weekend, come with us. And I always worked as a waiter on the weekend, so I just said, I can't, and I'm busy. But for some unknown reason, I was let go that weekend. The wedding had been canceled, and I thought, you know, this is odd. Maybe I should go with these people. And then it was 3 days of relentless disorientation and what I came to later understand, hypnosis and mind control techniques.
I would guess that your parents and friends were pretty concerned and tried to talk you out of it. When you heard critical things about your leader, how did you react to them?
Well, at the point that I got back from the workshop, my family was concerned, and they said I looked like I was on drugs, and I told them I had no idea whether any drugs were given to me without my knowledge. But the long and the short of it is once I had gotten involved again, going to a second workshop, I was indoctrinated to believe that any negative thought was actually an evil spirit or negative energy coming from Satan, which I didn't believe the week before. I didn't believe in Satan, but they had gotten me to believe that the spirit world is all around you and that this was God's movement. And so I was taught to do thought stopping, basically.
What's thought stopping?
Thought stopping is a behavior modification technique where when a thought comes in your mind, you're taught to block it and then replace it with another thought. And as a therapist, it's part of cognitive behavioral therapy to help people, for example, get out of depression if they're saying bad things to themselves, to catch themselves and say a nice thing about themselves or about their future. But in the case of destructive cults, what they do is they have the locus of control with the group, saying that any negative thought about them or about the leader is a negative thing. So, for example, my father once saw a newspaper article that Moon had an M16 gun factory, and he thought, I have the proof for Steve to get out. And he talked to me about it, and I just started chanting, crush Satan, crush Satan, glory to heaven, peace on earth, glory to heaven, peace on earth, true parents, true parents, true parents, as I had been trained to do. And then I thought, my father's possessed by Satan because he's trying to get me away from God's family.
And the true parents were Sun Myung Moon and his wife?
And his second wife, yes, current wife.
They were the Messiah, the double Messiah?
Basically the group believes that Adam and Eve were the original parents and that Eve got seduced by Lucifer and had sex with him and then she seduced Adam. So in their belief system, the restoration of humanity is through a perfect man and a perfect woman uniting and having perfect children. And that's the theme behind why all the mass marriages, that he's now adopting all these people into his true family. And you very much are led into this belief that he's 10 times greater than Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad. In fact, a few years ago, they took out full-page ads in newspapers saying that a dead unification leader has been teaching divine principle lectures, that's their doctrine, in the spirit world, and Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad have converted now to unificationism. And Lenin and Stalin and a few other people. It's just absolutely insane.
Well, it's no secret that the enormous literature, the press and transcripts of court cases, not to mention television coverage, used the term cult to describe the Moonies when they were, especially in the 70s and 80s, when they were very much in the press. Would you use that word today?
No, and yes. The term is so used and misused, and right now it seems that many of the group's leaders and their media and PR advisors are trying to do an attack on the word cult to try to make it seem like anyone who uses the C word is a hate person. Of course, the word cult can refer to a rock band, devout followers, or people who like Macintosh computers like myself. I was quoted in a book called The Cult of Mac. It can have a much more benign understanding.
So what's the best way to understand a group that exerts such control over individuals?
Probably with several adjectives like authoritarian, deceptive, manipulative, fear-based. I have a model that I talk about called the BITE model of mind control, And I say if you can control someone's behavior, their information, their thoughts, and their emotions, and give them a new identity that's dependent and obedient on a leader or on a group, you've got the recipe for a destructive mind control situation.
Is hypnosis involved in that process?
Yes, but it's not the image that many people have of someone sitting with a watch going back and forth hypnosis. It's much more experiential, or what we call naturalistic hypnotic techniques, where people are told they're going to learn something, like how to communicate better, but in fact they're then being taught how to go into an altered state of consciousness.
How is that done? I mean, what's a typical practice?
So, for example, in Scientology, I've counseled hundreds of people now, many former top executives in Scientology. They have training routines in Scientology where people are taught to sit, close their eyes, put their hands on their lap, and just be there. And they're flunked if they move at all over a period of minutes, and then it works their way up to hours of sitting still. And then the next level, if you pass that, is you have to sit still, staring into the eyes of a Scientologist for 15 to 20 minutes to start. And I've heard of people doing 2 hours with no blinking. And in my professional opinion, there's no way that a person could do either of those exercises and not go into an altered state of consciousness. Now, having said that, I want to also say that anybody, go in and out of altered states of consciousness all day long. And one of the more common examples is highway hypnosis, where you're driving long distances very competently, but you have no recollection of the last 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers because your mind is just in a flow state. Or if you're doing art or if you're doing sports, you just turn off your analytic mind and you just get into the experience. The problem when it comes to authoritarian groups with a hidden agenda, with a totalistic belief system and an absolute leader, is that going into that altered state of consciousness, you become so suggestible to step-by-step getting indoctrinated into these weird beliefs to the point where you're now distrusting your own ability to think. You're distrusting your family, you're distrusting your feelings, and reality gets recoded.
These days there's such an emphasis, though, on things called spiritual technology. Even meditation has been called by that term, ways that you can sort of use your mind in different ways and perhaps learn things very quickly by going into a hypnotic state. Now, some people would argue that's a good thing. They've used it positively.
Yeah, I use it positively. So I would agree. It's not the techniques itself that are the issue. It's how it's used, by whom, in what context. So myself, I belong to a Jewish temple. I pray, I chant, I meditate. I like to put my mind into neutral and just become very calm and watch my breath. It helps me get out of the stresses of life and helps me do my job to help people who have been traumatized. But again, one key point is that I'm doing it for myself. I'm in control. And in that form of meditation, it's a mindfulness meditation where I'm observing, but I'm not blocking anything off. I'm not doing thought stopping. And I'm open-minded to look at reality in different ways. When you get into one of these authoritarian groups, they say you have to look at reality their way, that they have the one truth. And it's basically a very fear-driven way of looking at reality, that if you don't do it their way, you're going to get cancer, you're going to be hit by a car, you're going to be abducted by aliens. I have 4 pages of the most common phobias in my second book, Releasing the Bonds.
Phobias, that's an interesting term to use. People think of it in connection to having to wash your hands 100 times a day and
That's more obsessive. Yeah,
obsessive compulsive.
And yeah, they have a phobia of germs, perhaps, is what's underlying that behavior.
Right. Are you saying that that particular groups induce phobias in their followers to keep them there?
Absolutely, that's what I'm saying. In fact, I'll go one step further and say that phobia implantation is the number one universal destructive mind control technique that across all the different groups and contexts. And I've helped people in political cults, therapy cults, religious cults, relationship situations where it's even one-on-one. But the structure of what happens in their mind is they can't imagine being away from the group, happy and fulfilled. They can only catastrophize in their mind. They can only get a rapid heartbeat and start hyperventilating, just as someone who has a panic attack, who has a phobia of being in a lift or of high places or such. Of course, if you had a phobia before you got recruited into the group, then it's even easier for the group to take advantage of that. So, for example, I counseled a woman who had a phobia of rats from her childhood, and when she got inducted into the group, she told one of her processors about this. And then they turned around and said, well, leaving our group will be like being trapped in a room with 10,000 rats for eternity.
I would have thought a fear of rats was normal, not a phobia, but that's probably my phobia.
No, I don't like rats either, but the point is that for her, just an image of a rat or hearing a cartoon with a rat in it would make her break out in a sweat and start hyperventilating.
Steve Hassan is a licensed mental health counselor and is one of the foremost experts on mind control cults that exercise unethical influence over their followers. And that's our subject on The Spirit of Things this week here on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. Steve became an active member of the Unification Church in the mid-1970s, which he says lured him by using deceitful recruitment methods and indoctrination techniques, which included sleep deprivation, lies, and love bombing. Before we return to Steve, here's a clip from someone who knew the Moonies intimately. About 6 years ago, I interviewed Sun Myung-moon's daughter-in-law, Nan Suk Hong, who became a child bride to Moon's son. After 14 years as a member of the True Family and virtually imprisoned in the headquarters of the Unification Church north of New York City, Nan Suk Hong made a harrowing escape with her children.
The first day I came into the compound, from that moment, from the time that I left, every aspect was controlled, where I lived and where I went to school, the people that I associated with. But it was more superficial relationship. I couldn't tell anybody who I was. One thing I learned very early, I learned that I couldn't trust anybody in that compound. I always had to watch out every word that I uttered. I had to think what this was going to do to me later on. It was very much the medieval court, I guess, lifestyle. Everybody is there for their political agenda. They're all there stabbing each other's back to get what they wanted.
So you were in a kind of constant state of fear as to whether you were saying the right thing or paying obeisance in the right way. Indeed, how did you pay obeisance to the Divine Mother and Father?
First of all, I was basically their maid. I was there before they got up. I served their breakfast. I was there from the morning till they went to sleep. And Reverend Moon has his meetings at his breakfast table. After that, they watched some Korean soap opera. And that's, I'm there serving them.
So you had to sit and watch the soap opera with Mrs. Moon?
Oh, and Reverend Moon as well, yes. And when they went for trips, well, I had to go as well. And whenever they felt like calling me, then I had to be there.
Well, Nansook, you had children, indeed 5 children, and they provided a great deal of emotional support for you.
Well, I was supposed to produce Reverend Moon's grandchildren, and that was one of my missions, and which I did. I had certain belief of how I wanted to raise my children. That didn't always follow Reverend Mrs. Moon's ideas of how children should be raised. And that was conflict, but I couldn't really go against what they were saying. And I had my way of asserting some of my ideas, but that was very difficult. Whenever they wanted to take the children to a different country, then they could. We couldn't really say anything. The grandchildren were more like ornaments to them. When they went to Alaska, when they went to Korea or different countries, they took their little grandchildren to show the members that it kind of provided good picture of being loving grandparents.
There was also a curious attitude that he showed toward your parents, who had done a great deal for him financially. You describe his need to humiliate the people who did good things for them.
That was the way for Reverend Moon to put people in place, especially people who are capable. A lot of people are there just taking money, and they're very incompetent. And my father, he brought a lot of money, and he gained a lot of respect. And I think Moon felt some threat, and he always had to put people in place by humiliating people in public. That was his tactic. He yelled, he called names about my dad in front of everybody, and that's what he did to me too. He, especially after my parents left, he, in front of my kids, Moon just yelled at me, called me names, and it was basically torture being there every Sunday. I had to listen to what he had to say.
Nansook, how did you manage to overcome your fear, the fear of being punished, the watchful eyes everywhere, to finally make your break from the group?
When you talk about fear, there are 2 types of fear, physical and also psychological. Psychologically, I think the fear was there since I was born. I was told that it was God's will and we absolutely had to obey it. And being a religious person, a person who has faith in God, you cannot conceive the idea that you will go against God. So I was in a psychological trap, and that was a very frightening thought. And also the physical fear, I constantly had to watch what my ex might do to me. That was always a concern, especially a year before I left. I knew that one day I was going to end up being dead. When I finally realized that I had to leave for my safety, and also the big part was my children's safety as well, I did plan very carefully, going to lawyers, at the same time going through a lot of soul-searching whether I was going against God. And I had help. I had support. My family helped. My best friend helped. So I was one of the lucky ones.
But the Moons did not give up so easily.
Well, I financially really didn't know how I was going to survive. I knew that Moon and the family and the church, they were going to fight to get the children back. And the major way of doing that is to pressuring me financially. It was a long legal battle. They used every tactic you can possibly think of. My ex declared bankruptcy to not to pay the money. And grandparents were telling lawyers not to pay a penny.
Nansook, it's one thing to break away from a life that has been something of a elongated torture. But then to write about it takes another kind of courage. Why did you feel you wanted to write this book?
When I realized that I had to leave, I decided that I had to write a book about my life. It's a perspective from inside. It was very central family, and not that many people have access to that. The idealism, the theory the church has, that of loving family, loving parents and children and brothers and sisters, and establishing the society and eventually the world for God, it makes a very good sense, and they have a lot of truth in it. But the Moon and the family, they do not practice what they preach, and not that many people have the access to the reality. I felt some sense of obligation. And it wasn't just for Unification Church members. There are a lot of cults, very destructive cults out there, robbing people's, I think, innocent idealism. It's basically a cautionary tale for members, for future members, and also for the relatives or friends whose loved ones are in that kind of situation.
Nansu Kong's story of her life in the Moon Compound is called In the Shadow of the Moons. Let's go back to my guest, Steve Hassan, who's dedicated his life to helping people free their mind from the effects of destructive mind control techniques. Steve Hassan, the term mind control has been subject to a lot of criticism. People have said mind control is just influence. It's everywhere. TV ads are an example. The church down the street that wants you to believe a particular interpretation of the Bible. Political parties you've mentioned. So why target a particular group?
Well, I basically target the whole phenomenon, and as I've been journeying over 30 years, and I've become a licensed mental health counselor and trained in a number of different subspecialties in psychology, I realize that there's a whole continuum of influence. I'm also the parent of a 3-year-old who has to tell my son, no, he can't run across the street without holding daddy's hand. And I realize that developmentally, children, it's irresponsible for parents not to exert a tremendous amount of control over their children's life in order to help them grow up and individuate. But we believe that once a person turns 18 to 20, 22, they should be capable of thinking for themselves, reasoning, making their own decisions. And essentially what is happening with these nefarious groups and individuals is they are not respecting someone's free will. They're actually taking a belief that the ends justify the means and that they are superior to everybody else and that they have a right to lie or to manipulate other people to get them to do the right thing, quote unquote, which they think is right. And the subverting free will. And so for me, I don't have a problem if a person wants to believe that a person is the Messiah or has the cure to cancer, as long as if they believe they have the cure to cancer, they're still going to their doctor and taking all the traditional treatments too. But if they're foregoing the treatments known to help with their medical condition, and they're just believing and giving all their funds to somebody who has a long history of being a huckster, I have a big problem with that. So essentially what I want to point out is that there's a continuum from healthy social influence and an individual influence, and the other side is a continuum to very destructive social influence or mind control. And when we start talking about groups that think it's okay to sarin gas citizens or do suicide bombs, and citizens are talking about very, very destructive mind control groups.
The sarin gas attack by the group Aum Shinrikyo is what you were referring to.
Yes, in Japan.
Well, since you were counseled out of the Moonies about 30 years ago, styles of intervention have changed, and that signaled even in your own works, your first book, Combating Mind Control, and your recent one, Releasing the Bonds, has a more strategic, family-oriented approach. Can you take me through your change of thinking?
Sure. Basically, in 1976, the style, the only known intervention method, was called deprogramming. It was, that term was started by a fellow named Ted Patrick. And essentially, you wanted to get the person physically away from the group, and you could lure them home and then stand in front of the door, or in some cases, actually grab them, put them in a van, and drive them somewhere else. I never did that particular thing. But the idea would be to try to snap them out of it. And so the approach was a very confrontative, harsh, you know, like, wake up, you're being used, don't you love your parents? And the method pretty much kept the parents and the siblings in the other room while the ex-members tried to wake the person up. And it worked. It worked also because the person was away from the group and given food, given sleep, and they weren't beaten or tortured, which is what the groups actually indoctrinate members with, phobias that, you know, deprogrammers are going to beat and torture you. So when that doesn't happen and they find out, the ex-members are kind of nice people and they're not frothing at the mouth and rabid, that often was enough to help snap them out of it. It was a method, though, that I was incredibly uncomfortable with because it just was harsh. And if you're talking to someone who has a phobia against leaving and you're just telling them they've got to leave, I mean, where do they go and what does the mind do? But that's essentially what was happening in the 70s and early 80s. After a year of deprogramming, I just said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be involved with any situation that's involuntary, even if I have a court-awarded conservatorship, which was what they were granting back then, to legally give the parents custody. But I still wanted to help. So I started learning about communication techniques, and I kept learning about everything I could about other groups. And it was a fascinating phenomenon that each cult group that I was dealing with, they thought they had the absolute leader and they had the absolute truth, but they thought the other groups were cults. And to put people from three different groups or four different groups in a room and have them talk about their own experiences in the group, everyone else could relate. A little different language, different leader, you know, different dressings, but it was still a very similar story about what was going on. And so I started basically doing voluntary interventions, which we started calling exit counselings, where the family would try to get the person to an isolated location, but then ask them to voluntarily meet. And it was a style of alcohol intervention, was what we were doing there.
You mean Alcoholics Anonymous?
No. I have my own problems with AA in terms of their beliefs that you're powerless and that only they can help you get over alcohol.
What do you mean by alcohol intervention?
So an alcohol intervention is when somebody has an alcohol problem and the family is concerned and the person is in denial and the family gets together with them and they all sit down, they take turns saying, you know, John, we love you, but, you know, last week you fell down the stairs and you almost broke your neck. Or you promised to get me a bicycle, Daddy, and you forgot my birthday, and Mommy had to bail you out of jail. So it's a loving but confrontative, you need treatment, Dad, for example.
So the strategic intervention style that you use now, how different is that from exit counseling?
I think it's very radically different, and it's different because I am spending way more time in the beginning meeting the family, meeting the siblings, meeting any concerned friends, educating them about the group, educating them about hypnosis and mind control and other groups. And from that, and I do family counseling if needed, or, you know, if the father is drinking, I want to get him working on that and getting help. If there are anxiety attacks, I want to deal with that, or sleep disorders. But with that as the foundation, then I start coaching them over time through the phone or through email and encourage them to go talk with a cult member and sometimes go to a lecture with him, but with coaching. because I've discovered more communication, if it's stylized and if it's designed to get the person to think for themselves, can be very effective.
So is the aim then to prompt the individual to self-help, to think for themselves, to actually take the initiative on their own?
Exactly. Because one of the big shifts that's happened over the years is the internet has come into play. And in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, people couldn't get access to content information, the documents of congressional investigations or the testimonials of former leaders or TV shows that had been done before. So they needed us to carry them with us and to show. But nowadays, ex-members are getting out of groups and they're wanting to warn other people, and they're going on the internet and they're going on setting up web pages, they're going on discussion boards. So, and with very strong search engines, it's not very difficult to find a lot of good information on a group. There are portals like myself, freedomofmind.com, there's factnet.org. There are a number of portals where people can say, have you ever heard about this group or that group? And we can check our database. And so the point is that the content is easier for people around the world to get access to. It's also easier to network with other resource people. So typically, when a family calls me concerned about one particular group, they've never talked with an ex-member from that group. They may have just been concerned because their loved one dropped out of college or quit their job or didn't come to the wedding of their beloved sister, gave over their trust fund or something. So they know, they've seen behaviors that are very concerning and not like the person would be. But they never sat down with an ex-member and had them explain step by step how they got, how the group indoctrinates and what the belief system is. And it's my experience that cult groups, authoritarian groups, are very predictable if you understand what the code words are, what the beliefs are, what the agendas are. And a lot of these groups want to recruit more people into them. So it becomes a process where a family member can say, I'm curious. This seems to be making you happy. Maybe I'll join too. Talk to me about it. And, oh, come to a lecture. Talk to someone else. Well, you're the person I trust. I'd rather you talk with me. You know, let's sit down. And it's amazing how much, and this is the bottom line of my belief system, is that deep down inside, people want to know the truth. The human spirit wants to be free. People don't want to be deceived and manipulated and exploited and guilt-tripped and fear-tripped. If they're given a set of choices, they're going to take the one that is best for them and is also best for their loved ones.
Steve Hassan is known as America's leading cult counselor, and his latest book is Releasing the Bonds, Empowering People to Think for Themselves. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National with me, Rachel Kahn. Now back to Steve Hassan. Through the Freedom of Mind Resource Center in Somerville, Massachusetts, and freedomofmind.com, Steve has helped many hundreds of people get a life after these soul-destroying experiences. I get the impression from your work, though, that focusing on groups and trying to get rid of them is not really your aim. It's more focusing on the dynamic, the kind of psychological, mental dynamic that occurs in a group. That's what people should be focusing on. That's what we should try to understand and perhaps get greater insight into.
Yeah, but I want to encourage greater consumer awareness in the general public so that people don't get sucked into these groups in the first place. I certainly want to see more governmental legislation that's safeguarding the public, that if a group is violating the law and subverting human rights, that they shouldn't be subsidized by charity laws and given benefits to help hurt a society's citizens. I'd like to see in elementary school and high school and college courses taught so that people can understand all the different forms of the new technology for influence that's happening. Just recently, there's a discovery about I believe it's oxytocin, that can help a person feel more trust to another person. And it's being experimented now with, for example, attachment disorder in adopted children to trust their parents more because they weren't there during critical early phases. But I think about how that could be misused.
You're talking about a drug.
Yeah, it's a neurochemical. But what I'm trying to say is that science and our understanding of the mind is advancing all the time. And we as citizens have to master our technology as opposed to being ignorant about what's out there so that we can be informed, responsible people and protect ourselves and our loved ones.
Well, Steve Hassan, you've certainly contributed to the general awareness of these issues, but you've also inadvertently taught particular groups who exert unethical influence what the score is, what the issues are. So aren't those groups becoming more sophisticated, too, in
Yes.
the way they present?
Yes, exactly. It's part of what is reality, I think, that we live in a complex system that's not static, and that somebody does something and someone else can learn from it and adjust their behavior. But that also forces another adjustment and another adjustment on the other side. And I think we have to really ask ourselves as humans, how do we want to live? Do we want to live in fear? Do we want to live in anxiety and depression? Or do we want to live with love and, you know, networking with trusted friends and family and saving our planet from global destruction? And I believe, I'm putting out my idealism, I believe that good people have to rise up and realize that if we aren't more active, that there are organized, well-funded groups that want to take over the world and make us follow their one truth with a capital T, whether it's a theocracy of Islam or Christianity or whatever. And I believe that there needs to be diversity. It's part of the healthiness of life and evolution, is that we learn from one another because we're different, as opposed to a Hitlerian scenario where everyone has to do the high step and do the Zig Heil. So I basically am very concerned that many citizens are stressed out, they're not sleeping properly, they're worried, and instead of doing something about it, even on a small level in their community, they're just kind of tuning out with drugs or antidepressive medications, and they're just saying it's hopeless, the system's falling apart, and they're giving up. And I'm saying you can't give up as long as we're breathing. We have to, you know, have a vision and move constructively towards it and figure this out together.
Steve, you mentioned Islam, and I'd like to ask you about that. After 9/11, there were, of course, and there has been continually a lot of articles concerned about Islam and its violent characteristics, etc. And you came in with an analysis that this was really a cult phenomenon, that to understand what happened mm-hmm. at 9/11 and subsequently, we're looking at cult behavior. How can that help us understand or react to or respond to the continued existence of terrorist cells?
That's a long interview unto itself, but essentially, I just see that there's not a war on terror. We're talking about specific people and specific groups some of them are decentralized at this point, but that are espousing a totalistic belief system, us versus them, black and white, and that violence is the only answer. And the Jewish groups like that and Christian groups like that, and I say Christian, I mean pseudo-Jewish, pseudo-Christian, pseudo-Islamic groups that are doing the opposite of what the Abrahamic religion is saying, which is love thy God with all thy heart, mind, and strength, and love others as you love yourself. It's about love. It's not about blowing people up. And so I just think that there's a religious, you know, element to all of this, but that what's really going on is that these individuals are not thinking. They're not analyzing. They're being recruited deceptively in many cases that I'm aware of, and indoctrinated into a different identity. They're often given a different name, and they're given a worldview where the purpose of life isn't this world, it's the next one. Therefore, the more you can destroy the evil Satan, the better. You'll be a hero. And I've talked to many Muslim leaders and friends who just say that's not what our religion is about. And what little I've studied of scriptures, one could go back and let's say, well, the Jews were ordered by God to destroy the Gentiles here, and the Crusades destroy the people who the church thought were needed to be converted or who were opponents. And I think that two wrongs don't make a right. If any historical scholar looks at that with shame of those periods in history, as opposed to saying, well, Muhammad said, we have to go and kill everyone else. It's the same type of scriptural error of taking things out of context and not realizing that love is the main context of all of the Holy Scriptures, and that God is one. There's not many little gods. There's one God. So, and that God wants us to love God and love others and love ourselves. That was a big thing that I had to come to realize after the moon experience, that the teaching is, how do you love yourself? In some ways, it's easier to say, I'll love others. But how do you love yourself? Well, you have to know yourself. It means you have to accept yourself. It means you have to be compassionate with yourself and all of its frailties.
Steve, working in this field, I can imagine it's not hard to be cynical about religion. How did you manage to maintain or resurrect a faith for yourself after the moon experience and after working with so many people hurt by excessively controlling groups?
It's been a long journey. And essentially, when I first got out of the Moonies, I was really angry and upset. I was angry at God. How could God let this happen to me? I spent hours every day praying. But I also came to realize over time that I had always believed in God, and that when I started thinking over my moon experiences, I realized I actually had a lot of experiences where I believe God was trying to say, yo, this is not right. And through my conscience, through my dreams, I actually saw Moon turn into the devil in front of my eyes during a lecture after a 7-day fast. But in the cult, you're taught, if anything, any revelation that is critical of Moon is Satan's revelation, so ignore it. But once I got out, I was like, what's this about? And it's taken me many, many years to reconnect with my Jewish heritage, and I found a very non-traditional rabbi in an independent temple in Boston, Massachusetts, that likes to take the best of the traditions and modernize it. As I said earlier, we pray, we chant, we meditate, we sing, we dance. We're a community of people. We're helping the homeless. We're teaching kids how to read. We're doing things. And that's one of the things I like about our temple, is that it's just not just preaching words. It's really about deeds. Like, what are you doing with your life to make a difference and to help others? And I guess I feel that it's important to have a faith in something bigger that can bring everyone together. But my faith in God is not to believe in a Zeus-like, you know, a human being on a throne that has predetermined everything. That's not my understanding. I believe God works through us, and that every day we can get revelations from our friends and from the newspaper that helps connect us with a divine spark and that helps us work to the greater cause. And so I can also tell you there's a lot of psychologists, people like Margaret Singer, Robert Lifton, who wrote about brainwashing and mind control, and they were not spiritually oriented. So they psychologized everything. And over the years, I've come to value the importance of talking about spirituality and what healthy spirituality is versus unhealthy spirituality. And I really do believe that that one can discern. For example, I wrote an article on my webpage, freedomofmind.com, called Spiritual Responsibility, Avoiding Abuses and Pitfalls Along the Spiritual Path. And I wrote two pages of assessment questions one could ask when one is considering going to a particular church or program, like who is the leader? What are his or her credentials? Do they have any criminal convictions? Are they claiming to be greater than anybody else? If so, what are their proofs? Are they doing miracles? You know, have you done independent research? Because I believe a legitimate group or a legitimate person, when I say legitimate, I mean healthy, will stand up to questioning and scrutiny. And what I've encountered is that illegitimate ones and unhealthy groups, they don't like questions. And they try to turn it around, make it your problem if you're not accepting them. And if you become clear about that point, that the burden is on them to prove how good they are, not for us to disprove it, and you take a good consumer hat that you wear as you walk around, say, you know, I'm valuable, my time is valuable, my money is valuable. If someone wants my time or my money, I need to read the labels, and I need to do more than read the labels. I need to go to the internet and research this group and see if there's any problems. And if there are problems, not just to listen to what the group says about themselves, but to talk to the critics and see for myself. Because I've yet to meet anyone who wants to go into a cult or wants to be in an abusive, exploitative relationship.
Well, Steve, it's great to have you on the program to be a champion of freedom of spirit and freedom of mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
In what's often a harrowing and dirty business, Steve Hassan struck me as a gentle warrior. He was my guest, and his latest book is Releasing the Bonds, Empowering People to Think for Themselves. Links to his website, freedomofmind.com, can be found on our website at abc.net.au/religion and follow the prompts to the Spirit of Things. Later in the week, you can also read a transcript, listen online, or download the program as a podcast. This week, sound production was by Michelle Goldsworthy, and the program was produced by me and Jeff Wood. Next week, we continue the theme when I speak to former followers of radical religious groups. It's a story about youthful idealism facing the brutal truth about control and power in religious groups. That's on the Spirit of Things next week with me, Rachel Kahn.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. and we're live on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.